isn't what we say or think that defines us, but what we do. Jane Austen. This is the What We Do by Kira Kazantsev podcast. Hello, hello, everyone. It is episode 21 of the What We Do by Kira Kazantsev podcast. This week, I am thrilled, honored, excited, all the adjectives, but seriously, to welcome Broadway star Kelly O'Hara to the show. The Tony Award-winning actress from Elk City, Oklahoma, has graced the stage in iconic productions like The King and I, South Pacific, Jekyll and Hyde, Nice Work If You Can Get It, and countless others. From Broadway to opera at the Met to roles on the silver screen, Kelly has really done it all. And she's maintained being just a wonderful, perfectly humble, awesome, down-to-earth person while doing it. So it just goes to show that you can keep your values and who you are true, even in the amazing fame that she has achieved and the force in the industry that she's become. So today, we're talking about her journey through the competitive world of show business, what it took to make it, constantly reinventing herself and evolving with the industry, being from a small town and moving to New York City and all the challenges that come with that, some nice stories about her most memorable roles, advice for those of you that want to follow in her footsteps, any future Broadway stars or actors or actresses out there, this is a good one for you to listen to, and of course, much more just about relationships and being a good human. So I would like everyone to know that I mostly kept my cool through this episode, even though I'm a major fan of Kelly's, so I'm glad that she was nice enough to bear with me, but she was just a joy to get to interview in New York City, and I hope you all enjoy this episode.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Hi, Kelly. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
For sitting down with me. We're here on your dinner break at work, and you're in the middle of recording, so I'm so thankful that you made the time to do this.
Well, thank you for being flexible. So here we are.
Well, thank you. So let's jump right in. I know you're short on time, so I would love if you could just start with a little bit of background of your childhood in Oklahoma. I know it's shaped you, and I've been reading a lot about you recently. So and I just love the story of you growing up on a farm in Oklahoma.
That's right. Elk City, Oklahoma, yes. Western Oklahoma, near the Texas Panhandle. Population at the time, about 8,500. I think it's grown to about 13,000. Wow. Yeah, my parents grew up there. They met in junior high. My dad's family farmed a farm, which my dad went back to farm after I was about three. We had lived in Tulsa for a while and moved back. So I really grew up in Elk City. Yeah, that kind of lifestyle really formed me. We worked on the farm. We were pretty earthy people. And I think as I've carried through my career, I try to keep, we have a lot of conversations about roots, you know, keeping your roots strong. And that's what they definitely taught me.
Yeah. I was in Oklahoma City recently for the first, I've never been to Oklahoma. And they have this train mural through Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, that's Kelly O'Hara. Your face
oh, really?
Is painted up there. Yeah.
Oh, well, what do you know?
Yeah. So you know you've made it big if you're on the
train mural at Oklahoma City.
In Oklahoma City. So I would love to hear about how you kind of got shaped through music. You know, you grew up on a farm and maybe wasn't what you thought as a little girl that you were going to do. Like, what was your big dream as a little kid?
That's a good question. I thought about this a lot because my sister and brother, we love singing, but how does one, is one born with this or are they influenced by something else? And because I can't explain kind of why it's inside me so deeply, why I just wanted to sing. And I didn't have the kind of parents who were stage parents putting me in all sorts of classes. We were just kids and we did love music, but my sister and I would sing. I've told this story, but I chop cotton in the summers, which means to chop the weeds down the rows of cotton. And my sister and I really made time singing duets as we did that. You know, we would wear our bikini tops to get a suntan and sing harmonies to better our singing. You know, I think that really shaped me that I was singing not for big audiences, because there just weren't those kind of things. I was singing in my living room for a family event or, you know, in somebody's backyard if it was graduation day or a school function. I never really sang for a big audience. And so I still think of singing in an intimate way. Like if I'm touching one person or if I'm singing about something that is really deep in somebody's heart, then that's the purpose of singing. So the older I get, the more nostalgic I get, things like that. And I'm a mom now, I have kids of my own. I definitely really appreciate how it all began for me, in that it wasn't about performing necessarily, but about making people feel things or having a purpose for singing. And so not really having the profession of it, but more the love of it in my life first, as opposed to the duty of it, is what makes it so alive for me.
So you probably didn't experience symptoms of burnout or something when you got to New York City.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. I think I've watched other kids or parents ask me about their kids. I was so hungry and ready by the time I moved to New York 20 years ago, because I hadn't been doing so much of it. And I had friends who came with me who had been the stars at home, and really they'd been working in the local theaters or
The lead of every play.
The lead of every play. And I was still kind of trying to feel my way out, and I was playing sports and I was doing other things. And we got up to New York and they just dropped off. You know, they decided to go home, and it's because they had kind of spent their time with it. They were done with it. And that now they've got great successful lives doing other things, whereas my beginning happened at that point, and I was just hungry. And I still am. I still find it invigorating.
So you studied opera in college, and then what was the precipice for Broadway?
Well, you know, I grew up on movie musicals. Again, I didn't have places to go see real theater.
There was no YouTube.
Yeah. Can you imagine? I mean, how does a person even learn how to live?
I don't know. Everything, I'm like, how do I put this thing together?
How would I make a meatloaf? You know, whatever. Well, no, that's a bad example because I have lots of moms and aunts in the
world. Well, I don't know how to do that. So
yeah, well, okay.
YouTube for sure.
Yes, YouTube. Fix a light bulb, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But no, I had nothing like that. So I was singing, I wanted to sing. So maybe I would sing country music or music from church or whatever it was, or Great Americana, you know, on the 4th of July. So when I did go to college, Oklahoma City University, to take lessons with this woman named Florence Birdwell.
There's something about OCU that just produces.
It's a great school.
Do you know Susan Powell by chance?
Well, here's my story, my friend.
Okay.
I'm from Elk City. Susan Powell is from Elk City.
Okay.
When I was 5 years old, Susan Powell won Miss America.
Yeah.
That ages me right there. It was 1981. She came back to town in her Fine Arts Center, which is called the Susan Powell Fine Arts Center, where I learned to play the clarinet, where I did all my voice recitals. I was 5 years old, and apparently she came down the aisle, and I was asleep, and she touched my face, and it was the best thing. It was my story for the rest of my life. A princess touched me is what I thought. I was five. And all I know is that I followed her. I followed in my mind. I saw that she went to Oklahoma City University. I saw that she studied with a woman named Florence Birdwell.
Yeah.
From the time I was five, even though it might have wavered, you know, I thought, I'm going to go to OCU and I'm going to study with Florence Birdwell, because that's what she did. And that's what I did. So Susan Powell is my reason for my season.
Wow. And Susan Powell's a former Miss America, for anybody that doesn't know.
Miss America 1981.
Yes.
And I should have, when you talked about Elk City, that's what I should have started with. And I will say this just because it's part of the story, not because I'm trying to float my own boat, but that Fine Arts Center, in her impact in this town as arts go, because there wasn't a lot of arts, was one of the most important things for me, because I saw that she went off and did good. And then we performed all of our plays in that theater. Well, they've just built a new state-of-the-art theater in Elk City, Oklahoma, and it's been named the Kelly O'Hara Center for the Performing Arts. And I cried. I don't care how many nominations for any awards I've ever had. When they called me, I was walking down the street in New York, and I had to stop and stand by a building, because I began to audibly and just weep. Because it was one of those things where you don't know if your dreams will happen. But it really all started back with that Susan Powell situation and that woman and that influence. And I wanted to make an impact like that as an artist. And so now I'm going home tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
I'm flying home. Good timing. I'm going home tomorrow to present my first scholarship for the Kelly O'Hara Center for the Performing Arts to a senior in high school who's going to get a degree in arts.
That's so amazing.
We all have those. We all have those inspirations, and it's everything to who we become. I went to study opera because she had, but I really loved those movie musicals and the musicals, and I wanted to be an actress. And so I went to college, and right out of college, I said, I'm not doing opera anymore. I'm moving to New York and going to acting school. And after that came musical theater.
Wow. So you get to New York. Mm-hmm. Do you know anyone?
Well, I didn't know a lot of people, but I did move to New York with four girls from OCU and UCO combined. And we had worked at Music Theater of Wichita the summer before. You know, we loved each other, the four of us, and we said, let's do it. Let's move to New York and make this thing
and
a reality.
Your parents were?
Well, now that I have kids, I have to say to my parents, you had to be really, really brave. I had never been there. I'd only been there one time when I was 21 was the first trip I ever took. So this was when I was 22. And they let me pack my two suitcases. I didn't really even have a place to live. I stayed on a friend's couch, looked for an apartment.
Classic.
No money. Nobody would rent to me because I had no money, no job, an out-of-state guarantor, whatever it was. It was terrible. It was awful. And it was awesome. You know, now I think back and I was like, remember when we were really kicking it?
You know? Well, so that's the true story.
That is the
New York story.
We paid our dues, you know. We pounded the pavement. We stood in audition lines, the four of us. And we all worked. Two of them were Rockettes. One is another big Broadway star. She's played many roles on Broadway. And the four of us are still the closest of friends. Wow.
So I am also obviously a huge fan of yours, but I'm also a big fan of Kristen Chenoweth's. And I met her when I was Miss America. And I know that she had competed in Oklahoma. And I got to meet her and she came up to me and said, I've been waiting to meet you.
Oh, wow.
And for me to hear that, I was like, I started crying.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering if she's influenced your career at all. And
you're,
she seems
asking,
like such
you're
a wonderful
asking all
person.
The right questions, Kara, because honestly, she had just left her master's at OCU with Florence Birdwell when I came in. So I was immediately kind of put in the Kristen Chenoweth box, you know, like as an opera major. So she'll do all the same coloratura roles and things. And so I was very inspired. Her picture hung on the wall in my teacher's studio, and she was out starting to make her way. Mm-hmm. You know, she got Steel Pier, and then she was in Charlie Brown, and all of a sudden she just became this new light for me. You know, this person led me here, Susan, and then this person is actually pulling me here, you know, leading me up, and that was Kristen. And when I was a senior, we didn't have a showcase. We had no way to get an agent. At the time, our college didn't have a showcase. Now they do, and kids can get an agent. So Kristen,
it's
nice. Well, it's a must. They have to, you know, to compete. And they're a great school and they should. And they have a great showcase and the kids get agents. But at the time, Kristen knew that. She was with an agency and she rented a space and she let Mrs. Birdwell bring 12 of us from her studio our spring break of my senior year. And that was that trip I'm talking about. And she let us audition for her one agency. Mm-hmm. And I got lucky and they signed me.
Wow.
And so I owe the next chapter to Kristen. And I'll tell you a great story about Kristen, which I've told before, but that when we were nominated for Tonys together this last round in 2015, and Mrs. Birdwell came, and, you know, she's in her 90s, and she came to support the both of us and everything. Right when we got the nomination, I saw Kristen at one of the cocktail parties that, you know, celebrating the nominees, and she hugged me in my ear, and she said, I want this one to be yours.
Wow.
Generous. And this, really generous.
But I wouldn't even say generous. I would say, like, she probably knew that you deserve it.
Well, but she did too, man.
Well, yeah, I'm sure.
Tour de force performance, you know.
I'm sure, but I can imagine that this business is very competitive, and that's
you
probably,
understand that,
yeah,
right?
But I mean, it's a little different because you're, you know, I'm not competing against people for roles every single day of my life forever. You know, it was one time, and for us, it was different. It was a crapshoot. Nobody had, as I'm sure it kind of sometimes is here, but, you know, it's not my entire lifestyle. And I'm not sure that I'd be able to handle that.
It gets tough. And I think you get, what you do realize is I said I was put into that Kristen Chenoweth box. And then you realize how beautiful it is that we're all very different. And then you aren't in the box anymore. In fact, we sell very different product, if you will, as performers. And we know that. And it allows for, it's spending too much time thinking you can be or should be in someone else's shoes. Mm-hmm. The greatest thing is if when you realize, and maybe when you get older, you start to realize this, how very different we are and how special that is, and then you can root for your friend, and you should always. I've always really tried to live that journey because it's too hard the other way. Mm-hmm. You know, really root for my friends because there's room for all of us. There really is.
Yeah, and I don't know if everybody thinks that way. I think that
they
might
don't.
Be a unique.
Well, I think that the thing that nobody realizes is that there is only one top, but nobody stays at the top forever. Yeah. So it's just timing. It's like, so this is your turn. I'll have a turn, you know, and that's the important thing to remember. You have to believe in yourself that you'll have a turn. You don't just say, I'll never have. But the great thing is to celebrate whose turn it is and not worry always about your own, you know.
But you also seem to be constantly evolving. Like you're on, you have this lengthy Broadway career, and now you're doing opera as well. Mm-hmm. So how is that? The differences between going from Broadway to opera and that whole process for you?
That's an interesting thing. I definitely wanted to get back to opera because it's what I studied and given a shot, and I've enjoyed it. And
like at the Met, no less.
At the Met. Yeah. And that's just, you know, that's, I don't know, good timing or something. But I definitely think that these things are hard. It's not just easy to go. You know, I do some television too, which I also think people in theater should get to do a lot of. We need to use a lot of our different muscles. Opera is a very, very much its own art form in a way. Being a stage animal is part of it, which I understand completely. Mm-hmm. But the singing, the technical aspect, it's a huge disciplinary thing. And I would never take that for granted. It's hard work. It's very hard work. And so I feel like I'm lucky to have given it a shot, and maybe I'll do more. But I'm not going to say, you know, you can just jump back and forth all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, you really have to kind of dedicate yourself to a type of singing. I mean, even in musical theater, I still sing kind of classically. You know, I'm not out there singing pop music. So I think that's why it's an easier transition. But I definitely know that I have to keep, and I love that word, evolving and trying new things and talking people into letting me, honestly. Because we can't.
I feel like that's not a tough sell.
Well, you'd be surprised. You have to keep changing it up, or you're going to just, you know, shrivel away.
Yeah. So you've done all these amazing things, but I'm sure are there still dream roles that are things that you've kind of, you know, are kind of in your back pocket? Like, this is something I still really want to work towards?
Yeah, you know, I feel like it's not necessarily like a revival role that people know about. Like, I've always wanted to play such and such. I mean, I've gotten to do some of those wonderful ladies, and I'm going to go and revisit The King and I this summer in London. Anna, who's a wonderful role. But I really want to do things that are, as I get older, as we watch women have more to say, or they always had great things to say, but now we're listening a little closer and we're giving more opportunities for that. I want to be involved in giving stories that are very relevant and more contemporary and not always in the past. I love telling those stories, but I've done a lot of that in my life.
Yeah.
And I want to do something current and contemporary and topical and relevant. And as a mother, as a woman, as a professional, maybe help to create something and do that, whether it's on Broadway, whether it's film, television, whatever it is. I'm excited about having a voice there.
So when it comes to those revival roles, is there, and you've done them beautifully, is there pressure in that? If, you know, people grow up watching The King and I or whatever it might be, and they expect you to be that version, but you want to do it in your Kelly version.
Yeah, that's huge pressure because, and, you know, it's especially, that pressure at the opera is huge. Mm-hmm. It's always like, this person sang this role, this person. In musical theater or theater, it's not as much pressure because we really do attack something in a brand new way. We try not to repeat and just rebuild something that's already happened. In other words, and also you don't do something if you don't have a reason right now, politically, whatever it is, to do it again. So it's really this show, but for a 2018 audience. And so I make a point never to go watch them again. I don't go back and revisit the roles. I just go to the source and say, of the material, and say, how does this affect me as a person right now, my age, 2018, mm-hmm. mother of two, whatever it is. And that's how I make it more human in my own way and bring in a different, you know, eye to it. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it different, because none of us are the same. And to do it, just to do an imitation is just a waste of time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's pressure, but then there's actually kind of something beautiful in having a chance to re-explain something.
Yeah. I mean, I can only imagine what that must feel like to be able to define that role mm-hmm. in your way, but still giving people, because people must feel, you know, they feel that nostalgia of, you know, I watched this with my grandmother or my mom, and this was a special moment, and you're giving that special moment to the audience.
Yeah. The biggest time when I did that was when I realized how much this is in the fabric of our lives is when I did South Pacific. Mm-hmm. And we had so many people from World War II that were still able to come, or somebody brought their parents, or someone's parents had just passed away and they had listened to South Pacific all their lives. And they don't come in necessarily, they don't even come in judging you up against the one they heard. They come in just wanting to experience it live. And the fact that it's happening live for them as opposed to on a record player or in a memory of their mom or dad, they would get so emotional and they would relive all these childhood memories. And I could tell that it really wasn't about any comparisons. It was just about the opportunity to have it. I mean, that's why we have to keep doing them.
Yeah. So you mentioned you're a mother of two. Yeah. And I know probably people ask you a lot about how balancing kids and Broadway.
It's fine.
Yeah. So clearly you're figuring it out. But my question for you as a mom is, how important is an arts education for kids, especially, you know, in maybe in a small town in Oklahoma? I can't imagine that every small town has the infrastructure or the desire or the people there that are nurturing those types of skills. So middle America, small town, how do those kids pursue a dream like this?
That's a great question. That's why this Fine Arts Center is so important to me. And I want to try to go back and really encourage the idea that arts, even if that's not something you go into for your whole life, even if you try not to go make a living in the arts, which can be done. And there's so many facets of that. People don't realize, they think it's just singing and dancing, but there's so many facets of the arts that are healing. But I want to go back and really encourage the use of the facility and the belief in it, because the New York Times did this great article, and I can't even remember it now. It's been 8 years. It was when my son was born, and I was very into it. And it took all these professionals, whether they be on Wall Street or surgeons, or, and they all talked about how arts had influenced their education, how it taught them discipline, how it taught them how to communicate better, taught them how to feel things or to explain things that were confusing or emotionally too mature. I think that people don't realize how important it is to be able to communicate that way. And the more we cut arts out, obviously you see the less communicating we're doing in the world at all. You know, we're really not communicating in a deep, non-surface way. We don't have to. But arts kind of begs you of it. You must.
It's an emotional process.
Yeah. In order to see something fully, hear it, observe it, take it in, it's because you're actually feeling, and you, if you allow yourself to do that, then there's more compassion in the world. We have a lot less war, and it's just, it's the truth. And I know I'm an artist, so that sounds, it, you know, whatever, blah, 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 but syrupy, but I know it works. I've seen it. I've seen it with kids who aren't from artistic backgrounds, who are affected by these programs that different arts organizations have, like the New York Pops, or this organization I work with called SAY that helps kids who stutter, and these kids who just come in and find art and they find their voice for the first time in their life. You know, I watch it happen. It makes them better people.
Yeah. So I'm a first-generation American. I still have Russian grandparents that live in Russia. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather speaks English, but everybody else only speaks Russian. And for them, the sound of music
of course.
You know, one of the only things that they could ever listen to, because arts were so limited. Mm-hmm. So growing up, for me, the Julie Andrews and the Sound of Music was—
That's why I'm here.
Yeah. That was just my way of, A, communicating with them and seeing the world in a much brighter place. Mm-hmm. So I just feel like that's the type of power that music can have.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's my family, we would watch it every year around Christmas time, and it was the gatherer, it was the conversation starter, it was the tearjerker. It was everything that, and maybe cultures that don't do that as well. I mean, we're a big Irish family, so it's not always easy. It was the thing that connected us all, you know.
Yeah. So in terms of connections, mm-hmm. I'm gonna switch subjects here. When you get to New York, I want to go back to this when you first got here. Mm-hmm. For any young girl that gets to New York, how important is the network and the connections? And if you don't know anybody, how does one begin building that sort of network? Because a lot of the audience is young women, ages mm-hmm. 18 to 24, that probably have big dreams of following in your footsteps. So how do they start that if they don't know anybody?
That's a good question. I didn't, except then I realized I did. And I think that's the important thing. It's, you don't actually know where your connections are or who, and until you start to really think about it, to look, to open yourself, open the doors up to receiving, you know, some friends of friends. I knew Kristen, you know, a little bit, who then helped me. Just having my band of girls was my connection to believing in myself, to really keep going when I didn't know anybody. Whatever your job is, of course, mine was going and standing an audition. Maybe another girl's is to go and have an interview. There was a little bit of naivete in me, which I think really helped, because I just assumed that I was going to make it, you know, and so I was
just blindly believed.
I did, and I didn't. I tried not to be too educated in the hardships, mm-hmm. because there would be hardships, and there were, and I knew it. But if I concentrated only on the what ifs like that, then I wouldn't really keep going forward. And so I know that's not advice; it's more of a feeling. But in other words, don't be afraid of that. Don't be afraid of if you're not the person who knows everything in the room. In fact, there's somebody in the room who actually finds that appealing. Mm-hmm. You know, as far as like someone who's hungry, someone who's just here to work, someone's not here to like maybe hobnob their way all over the place to the top, but someone who's actually hungry to work and make a place for themselves. But I do think connections are important here. I mean, we need someone to open the door, and then you kind of have to get in and do your work once you get there. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a moment like that where you kind of were like, you know what? No, I'm going to go back and tell them that I need this, or a moment where you had to really fight for a role?
Yeah, you know, I do have a story where my first big role on Broadway was in a show called The Sweet Smell of Success, and it was John Lithgow and Marvin Hamlisch wrote them. It was the big project, and I really believed that I should have this role. I mean, it was so naive of me. I'd only done a couple of Broadway shows, but in the ensemble, and but I couldn't get an audition. I couldn't even get an audition. And so I crashed it. I went and like banged on the door. Yeah. And I kind of did that. I kind of said, you know, I'm your girl. I don't think I've ever been that ballsy since or before, but there was something in me that thought it's either go hard or go home, you know, just because I really did connect to the material and I thought it would be good for me. I ended up getting that job, but it was by way of convincing them that I had something to give them. I had something to teach them that they didn't even know. And I was naive all the way through it. And yet, that's just what the role called for. I mean, I think in other businesses, and I can't speak on it too well, but nobody needs you to come in knowing everything. They need you to come in ready to learn. And I think people try to be perfect. And they also try to be too well-prepared, too educated. You can be plenty educated. You should be. But my point is that it's really the person who comes in and says, but I'm here to work and I'm here to learn. Not the person who says, I know. Because the leader is going to look at you and say, well, then I don't really have anything to give you, do I? You know, I don't have anything to teach you. Good leaders, let me say it that way. Good leaders see someone who is a little rough around the edges and actually would believe in that. And the leader wants to have something to shape.
Something malleable that's not maybe like a diva personality.
Exactly. Or just someone who's so brittle and wants to be a perfectionist that you can't get inside them. You can't.
Or they'll break.
Yeah, you can't actually tear them down a little to build them back up. I mean, my teacher was really that way. She was hard on me, but I think she knew there was something in there. But boy, did she have to rip away for a while before she could find it and then help me build it back up. I think people are too afraid to not be everything all at once. And when we're young and we're starting out, there's nothing kind of more beautiful than just being willing to be there and be hungry and be ready.
So I think that the layperson might not quite understand the culture of Broadway and like industry people, how you all interact with one another. So is there a way that you would kind of explain what this little world, it's a large subculture.
It is.
But how would you kind of explain this to somebody that might not be very familiar with Broadway and maybe why they should be interested in it?
Oh, that's good. You know, Broadway's filled with just a lot of amazing, actually really people like you'd see next door. I mean, we have families, we get married, we have kids. Our schedules are a little weird. We work in the evenings for a few hours a night. It's not as crazy as it sounds, but it's a lot of work. But we come up through the arts channels just like anybody else in school, like through an education program or maybe you come right to work. But most of us get degrees and study music and we know how to read music and we know the history of things like music and theater and literature. And then when we get up here, it's a very, very small world, but it's fiercely tight. And I think as much as we're competitive, we also would fight for each other. It's a group of people that really believes.
What are two or three shows that you think every human should see before they die, no matter what? Just as a educational, like, you have to see this because it will make you a more complete human.
Shoot. That's a good question. I mean, I think that I'm a Rodgers and Hammerstein girl, but I'm also contemporary stuff. I'll jump on the bandwagon and say you should see Hamilton because I feel like I know that how can he strike it with every single person, but in a way, somehow he does. If you're willing to learn and receive and think of history the way he's thought of it and receive it the way he's giving it, it's a hugely educational thing. It really is. And also, being an American, you know the history, and so you follow it in a different way. I think that's very important. I think something like, and I'll just say it, King and I has an aspect of acceptance, equality, both gender equality, racial equality, compassion, education. I mean, we have two people, very educated people, but very stubborn and from different parts of the world. and man and woman who have to actually learn how to work together. Mm-hmm. We have women working together within that show that's very strong. I think if you're willing to look at the messages, that's very important. And then, of course, there are, you know, if you want to go see Fun and Froth, there's lots of those things. Yeah. But I think that a lot of people that don't know Broadway think of like some sort of silly movie musical where people are just dancing and singing, when I think there are a lot of musicals that have real message, real depth in them.
And what about someone that might not understand how it all comes together? Like, what is the audition process like, and what is your preparation process like?
Right. Well, we all audition, and then you have about 5 weeks of rehearsal, and we're in every day, 10 to 6, and you're learning the dances and the songs, and you're sitting around and talking about the characters and your history. And when you are doing a show like that, you learn about the world you're in. You learn about World War II, or you learn about the Civil War, which is, you know, during the time Lincoln and of King and I. And you learn exactly where you are in your history if you're going to play the characters truly. And then we have a preview process where people can watch the show, but we're still changing it during the day. We're learning things by the audience's reaction, changing it the next day, doing it again that night, learning. And then finally we open, and then we run, and that's a set show, basically.
And you, eight days a week.
Yeah, 8 days a week.
Yeah.
So eight shows a week.
8 shows a week,
six days.
Is crazy.
Yeah, it is a lot, yeah.
So I read an interview you did with Renee Fleming for The Times, and it struck me that I'd never realized that at the Met you don't use a mic, but in Broadway, obviously, you do. So doing 8 shows is probably a little more feasible. As like,
you know, that's exactly the reason for it. I mean, a lot of people, we also talk in musicals. You know, we have a lot of dialogue. It's a play with music. And so we must have amplification, really, to go over the music, to go over the big orchestra. But also it's for perseverance. You know, I mean, preservation is the word I'm looking for.
And also perseverance.
Yes, and also for perseverance. But it's because we have to be able to last that many shows. And even if you're singing correctly, there's no way you'll not be fatigued. At the Met, we do 2 shows a week, and you can rest.
Because you're like using your
whole body,
yeah,
to get
that sound
thing
out.
Yeah.
And how many seats are in there? How many people?
Like 4,000 people at the Met. Yeah.
Wow.
Try not to think about it too
much.
It's
not a small room.
No.
Small room of friends.
Yeah, right.
Kelly and 4,000
of
her friends.
Exactly. My God. I hope they're my friends. I'm not sure everybody was, but you do the best you can. But it's funny being at Broadway, you can have a little bit of anonymity, you know.
You're not big on social media or anything.
Well, I mean, I try. I'm a pretty private person. I'm just.
But how is that like? Is there like a. Not a facade, but like there's some mystery about it, because people, if they know Kelly for you, does that affect how you play a character?
You know what? Ding, 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 my friend.
okay.
I don't even have to explain it to you. If people know me, Kelly, too well, how can they believe me as Anna? How can they believe me as Francesca? How can they believe me? Yes, I could be a great actress. I could try, I mean, but we still see, if we know a lot about the character. I mean, think about Meryl Streep if you want to, or Cate Blanchett, who aren't big social media people. You don't know enough about them. And so you wonder how much of the character is them and how much they're playing, and then there's a mystery about it, and then it's thrilling. I wish for you to walk in and see me in theater and see the character I'm playing, not to see a character of Kelly, you know, me just doing Kelly, saying the lines of this other character. I don't have any room for that in my life. I want to be an actor. I want to be an artist who changes your life in that viewing. So I have to tell the story deeply and purely and truly. And if most of what you're seeing is the Kelly that you're so fond of or dislike or whatever it is on social media, then you can't quite unhinge that from your mind. It's not your fault, but I've given you too much information. I mean, I'm political. I have a lot of passion, a lot of thoughts. I want to answer a lot of things.
I'm sure.
But I'm also not going to really justify that. You know, my time is for my kids and for my work. And I do sometimes. I'll definitely advertise things I'm doing, and I'm excited
about it.
I'll do a podcast with you.
Thank you.
But I don't want to be, you know, every single day you can just reach me and get my goat, as they say, by saying something mean, and then I respond to you, and then all of a sudden you've gotten into my heart. I'm a little protective that way.
Yeah. So on that, like, I'm sure there's been some negativity through the years, or maybe somebody giving you a critique that really stings, or a review you didn't like. How do you decide to always keep going?
You know, you really have to trust how you feel when you're doing this, that kind of thing. And you have to see the response you're getting sometimes. I read a review in my very first professional show. at the Downtown Cabaret Theater in Connecticut. It was when I first got my equity card. I just moved here and I read the review because I was just so excited. I was in the paper. And it was something about, it wasn't horrible, but it was something about, oh, she must have been hired more for her singing than her acting.
Oh.
And that stuck with me. I mean, I went to acting school. I was like, I'm going to be a better actor. I've tried so hard to work to be a better actor. And so my skin is thin. But I also remember loving that show. I loved how I felt when I did it. And the people seemed to love it. And what I took from that is I really never read a review again. Because even if I'm terrible, which I'm sure there have been lots of those, but I have to know how I'm feeling about doing it and how much I love it and how much it gives me and how much it gives other people. And I can't worry so much about one person. And that's kind of why I don't do that. And I don't spend a lot of time on it because we have to do the show 8 shows a week for a year, maybe sometimes or more.
That's so crazy.
And if I felt like, well, everybody thinks I'm bad, if I knew that, then I'm not the kind of person who's tough enough just to keep going. I want to know that I'm doing something that's worthy of people's time and my own.
And you also have to probably believe that the people that have given you that role believe in you. And
yeah.
You weren't given the role. You earned that role.
That I earned it and I'm here for a reason.
Yeah.
And I think we spend too much time on, and that's another thing with, I mean, social media. I have a lot of friends who really need that reaction from everybody.
It's like that little dopamine.
Yes,
hit.
It's a little bit of hit.
Yeah.
But you know what? I know that I can't make everybody happy. I know that. None of us can. You can't. I can.
Yeah, I
can't.
I certainly cannot.
we just can't because people have a different aesthetic about life in general. I just don't like blonde girls, you know? Well, I'm out, you know?
Sorry.
Yeah, you know, you're out.
I'm out too.
We're out. But the thing that we have to realize is there is a place. There is a place for us. There is a place for all of us. And that's what I love is to—
That's a good song.
Yeah.
Right? There's a place for us.
Ah, who did that in Sondheim? But it's true. I mean, I think that's what he's singing. I mean, he's writing about is that the fact that—
I'd just like to point out that I successfully
dropped a
Broadway— reference.
Yes, you
Thank
did.
Thank you. Thank you.
You just dropped that mic right on the floor.
See, I'm not completely clueless.
No, you
I
got
do
it.
Enjoy the aughts.
You do.
I love
you.
Yeah. Do. I mean, I'm trying to be as cool as I can, but like, you're such a big deal. So I'm like, okay.
You're very sweet.
So.
And very ugly. Just all your listeners, she's very, very unattractive. Yeah. I don't know if you knew that.
Thank you. You know, I really appreciate honesty, and it's really just an
just,
honorable
just
quality.
Cute little freckle. Just like perfect skin.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to have
I
to go get like a facial pretty soon. Making me feel
no, I've
aging.
Got, I actually have a little bit of acne happening.
Oh, right? Like, is that what's happening?
Yeah.
Please.
You know.
Please.
But that's real life. Anyway, going back to what we were talking about. Oh, okay. So I really wanted to ask you, if for whatever reason, which this would never happen in real life, Broadway didn't happen for you.
Oh, yeah.
Is there something else that you're like, I could have done that? Or like, did you ever have a backup plan? I'm assuming you didn't because you were like, I'm just doing this.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is I didn't have a back. I was so naive and certain that I was going to do this. I didn't have a backup plan. I definitely love to teach. I teach master classes at different universities around the country. I definitely thought at the time I might teach. I also went into the idea of doing entertainment law, which because my dad was a lawyer.
Yeah.
At one point, I wanted to be a veterinarian when I was a kid. No,
well,
but,
you know,
yeah,
showing pigs
showing
will do
pigs.
That.
That's, you know, we were a big animal family.
Yeah.
But I really never had a backup plan. And that's kind of scary. I don't have any other skills.
I'm sure that's not true.
No, I'm terrible.
Your best skill ended up really working out.
Well, phew.
Yeah. So, okay, I had this whole list of questions for you. I didn't really ask you any of them, which is great because we just had a normal conversation.
Yeah.
But the one question on here that I wanted to ask you before I let you go is I think that we all have defining moments that like, if this hadn't happened, I wouldn't be here. If this one thing hadn't happened. So I don't know if you have something like that was really a defining moment that led you down a certain path, but I think those are really important in life.
Absolutely. My defining moment was, I mean, I came up here and I was working, so I was going to work, and I think I would have worked, you know, after this but the way I've worked since I met my husband is a different. I'm not one of those people who believes that I ever sacrificed to have a good marriage or give my husband my time or make a partnership with someone else who needed me or I needed him. I think of it as I've become doubly strong. And the way I was raised was one way, the way he was raised was another, and the way that affects me as a person and the way we raise our children in the way I viewed the arts, because he's an artist too, has changed so drastically since I met him that I think after that, my work just became different. And my life became different, obviously, and it's enriched so beautifully with our children. But I also think he just allowed me to just be a better artist, a deeper artist. And he's a good person, so.
I think that's so amazing that you are able to have such a strong, healthy partnership in an industry that sometimes those relationships are feeling like a little far and few between.
They are, and I've actually looked for inspirations. I have. I've thought, who's somebody that's making it work? Because it is hard. I'm not saying we're the prince and the princess and went off into the, you know, happily ever after. Every day is a balance. But the way we view what we do for a living and how to also have a life, but also give it real worth, the arts that we do and what we put into it and when it's necessary and when it's not. In other words, if my work was all I had, I feel like it would be a little bit of an empty shell. But the way I can compartmentalize, this is really valuable to human nature, you know, and me and myself. And this is not. But this would feel good, or this would pay you a lot of money, or this would give my ego a big boost. The way we can kind of make those decisions together, and he's pulled me down off my, you know, pulled me down off the tree once in a while, or sent me soaring on other times. I'm just a different person from having met him. And I was randomly set up with him on a blind date. And I do think that was a big life changer for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me preface with the young ladies. I didn't find that husband until my 30s, so take your time.
Yeah, there we go.
There's no rush. I had a lot of time for myself, and I used it wisely. But yes, but thank you. Wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you so much for joining us, and I can't wait to get this out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yay!
Thanks so much.
Can we take a picture before you run away?
Thanks for listening. Tune in every Wednesday for the latest episode of the What We Do by Kira Kazantsev podcast. Follow at Kira Kazantsev and at What We Do Podcast on Instagram for the latest podcast updates, or go to whatwedo.live or whatwedopodcast.com for our blog, bonus content, and info. Questions? Email us at info@whatwedo.live. See you next week. What We Do by Kira Kazantsev is mixed and mastered by Resonate Recordings. Interested in starting your own podcast? As a What We Do listener, you can go to resonaterecordings.com to get your first episode produced for free. Just let them know we sent you. If you have a podcast or are considering starting one, I can't recommend them enough. They are amazing audio engineers that understand podcasting like no one else. Go to resonaterecordings.com to get your first episode produced for free today.